The matter of Horace Cowan versus New Jersey State Parole Board. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Scott Welfel, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Cowan, you can assist with COAGN.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Andrew
Rosenberg, on behalf of the Periodic Good morning, Raymond Brown, on behalf of Stein Walter Hayden, Association of Civil Defense Lawyers from New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Joseph, Civil Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the New Jersey State Parole.
Good morning and welcome, counsel. We're going to go till 12:30, so we're not going to finish the argument. By then, we'll see how far we can get. Mr. Welfel, please. We will then break for a half hour for lunch. Go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve just a few minutes for a rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. Over 35 years ago, Horace Cowan committed several terrible crimes when he was 22 and 23, crimes he now recognizes were the product of a morally impoverished outlook. He was just trying to get money the easy way, robbing people, without regard for how his actions harmed others. But now, 30 plus years of incarceration, he's accepted full responsibility for his crimes. He's expressed sincere remorse, and he's recognized that his youthful outlook was wrong, and that he needs to obviously take into account how his actions harm others. Many letters in the parole package recognize and attest to this transformation in his current character. And now, he doesn't have a spotless prison record, but few inmates do. And I think it's worth noting that the majority of his infractions were in the first two decades of his incarceration, but since 2011, there have only been four. And most of his programming has been in this last decade. Now, obviously, the question before this court is not whether the board properly denied parole, but assuming denial was proper, was the board justified in saying Mr. Cowan couldn't even be considered for parole again for another 200 months, which is more than seven times the presumptive parole FET of 27 months. Now, the lodestar for release is whether or not the board has proven a substantial likelihood of committing a new crime if released. And for those inmates that the board has determined don't meet that standard at first eligibility, they've published a schedule of future eligibility terms or FETs. And for inmates like Mr. Cowan, who've been convicted of manslaughter, aggravated manslaughter, the presumptive FET is 27 months. They can adjust that up or down by 9 months, but to go beyond the maximum of that range, of the 36-month maximum, and impose the 200-month FET they imposed here, as Berta tells us, the board has to explain why 36 months is insufficient to reduce Mr. Cowan's risk of recidivism, and why 200 months is necessary. The board failed to do either in this case. So I'd like to structure my argument in three parts. First, why the articulation of the standard in Berta is correct. Two, why the board failed to meet the Berta standard here. And three, on remedy, why the remedy should be remand for a new parole hearing rather than reconsideration of the FET. So on the first point, so first, why is there a presumption of the scheduled FET? Well, the statute 123.56A, and I'm gonna refer to just the last several digits for shorthand. So that's a subsection A directs the board to publish a schedule of FETs, and then subsection B says upon denying parole, the board shall refer to that schedule. And in enacting the regulations, for the schedule that's published at subsection A of regulation 3.21, and for this case, inmates convicted of aggravated manslaughter shall serve an additional 27 months. So that's why there's this presumption, and the starting premise is that 27 months in the schedule. Now, as far as why the risk of recidivism has to govern going beyond that. All three published cases to look at this have reached that same conclusion, beginning with this court in Trentino 4, which said that the board's decision that Trentino will not be eligible for parole for another 10 years did not focus sufficiently on the likelihood that Trentino will commit crimes if released, but instead focused on the achievement of complete rehabilitation, which is not the standard for release. And then McGowan, the appellate division, said Trentino clarified the requirement that the board focus its attention squarely on the likelihood of recidivism for the FET determination as well, and actually said that the board's revision to the regulation 3.21 was meant to reflect what this court said in Trentino 4. And then Berta just spells it out a little more explicitly about how this should operate. So Berta says, one, there's the presumption that the FET will be within the schedule. Two, and this is on page 323, quote, the board must overcome the presumption by explaining why the scheduled FET is clearly inappropriate, quote, tied directly to the goal of reducing the likelihood of future criminal behavior. Oh, and I apologize, just because I haven't gotten any questions, I've completed my opening. So if there's any questions at any point, jump in. And then three, the board may only impose an FET as may be needed to reduce the likelihood of future criminal behavior. And Berta focuses mostly on the language of the regulation itself, which it was fine and appropriate, but our position is that it's also commanded by the structure of the 1979 Parole Act. And so the regulation itself does apply to folks both 79 Parole Act and 97 Parole Act, but our position is actually that standard is commanded for folks by the statute in the 79 Parole Act.
And that's because the 79 Parole Act is the one that talks about whether there's a substantial likelihood that the inmate will not commit a crime under the laws of this state if released on parole at such time, whereas the 97 Act has a different standard for parole can be denied. So your argument is specifically that for 79 Act, for inmates to whom the 79 Act applies because they committed their crimes and were convicted before 1997, this is the standard that applies in the statute, and therefore it has to apply in the regulations as well.
That's correct. We take no position on whether the board could change the regulation, have a different standard in its regulation for 97 inmates. So
for 1997 inmates going forward under the new statute?
Yes. The regulation has the same standard. We are saying that standard is also commanded by statute for 79 inmates, but take no position on whether they could, if they wanted to, change the standard for 97 inmates. And this is, of course, because the 79 Parole Act affected a radical change in the parole system by creating a presumption of release at the time of parole eligibility. And the Assembly Judiciary Law Public Safety Committee statement shows the reason for this change was to make parole release decisions more objective and reduce discretion by making the likelihood of recidivism the sole standard and replacing the prior discretionary standard of the 1948 Act, which looked at whether the inmate would take his rightful place in society and very much was subjective and discretionary. And requiring the board to rebut the presumption of release and putting the burden on the board recognizes it's impossible for a person to prove he will not do something, so it's on the board to prove he will do something. And so this court recognized in Trentino 6 that an inmate has a constitutionally protected right to parole unless the state can prove there's this substantial likelihood that he will commit another crime. And sentences actually incorporate the expectation and the right to parole. So if you look at 2C 43-2 subsection E, a judge must consider the defendant's eligibility for release under the law governing parole at the time the sentence is set. And the committee statement from the Senate Law and Public Safety Committee at the time that the 79 Act was passed recognized that putting the burden on the board and creating a presumption better complements the generally longer sentence of the 2C that was enacted at the same time. And the power to decide how long somebody should be imprisoned belongs to the sentencing court rather than the parole board. So a sentence of life with 30, which is what Mr. Cohen had here, it's not a presumptive sentence of life with the possibility that you get paroled if you're good or if you meet certain standards. It's actually the presumption of release. It's presumption of release at 30, unless the board can prove you're substantially likely to commit a new crime. And so that presumption of release is actually factored into part of the sentence. So if you're denied at hearing one, because at that point there's a substantial likelihood of recidivism, that same presumption applies at hearing two, right? When you come back, the board again has to release you unless it can prove there's the substantial likelihood of recidivism. So if they're gonna hold you way beyond the point at which your risk of recidivism is no longer going to be substantial, that's effectively modifying the sentence, as Judge Geiger recognized in his concurrence in Berta. And that's why the length of the FET must be tethered to the likelihood of recidivism. And as Berta says, the parole board may only impose an FET as may be needed to reduce the likelihood of future criminal behavior. So on what that means, I just want to address a couple what I perceive to be mischaracterizations of our position in the board's brief. So on page 19, the board says that our position means that the FET, if an FET is beyond the schedule, it must reflect the board's forecast of when the inmate will satisfy the criteria of parole. And we think that's incorrect. It should be framed the opposite. The board just has to explain, not you're going to be ready at 200 months or whatever it is, but that, you know, there's two questions. First, departing from the schedule and then setting the length. So just on the departing from the schedule, the board must explain, here is the evidence why we think you won't be ready. You won't meet the standard at the end of 27 or 36 months. It doesn't lock the board into granting parole at the end of that period. It's just saying you get a chance to be considered at the end of that period. And then on page 26, the board says, Berta never equated the time appropriate to address a lack of satisfactory progress in reducing the likelihood of future behavior with the time of the likelihood of recidivism to drop below the substantial standard. But I see that as the only logical conclusion. If you have, at date two, you still have that presumption and you still have to be paroled unless there's this substantial likelihood that you'll commit a new crime. And so if we look at just the language of the regulation, to depart from that, you have to show it's clearly that scheduled period is clearly inappropriate due to the inmate's lack of satisfactory progress in reducing the likelihood of future criminal behavior. What does it mean for it to be inappropriate? It means it's not going to be long enough to reduce the likelihood of future criminal behavior. So we think that's the only logical conclusion. So that's
Is there a mischaracterization of your position in that, or are you agreeing with their characterization of your position on page 26?
I'm sorry. The first point was, I think, was a mischaracterization. We just, on page 26, we just think Berta and the statute do support equating the length of, or tying the length of the FET to the substantial likelihood of recidivism. So thank you for the correction. I apologize.
I don't want to interrupt your flow. So I've got some questions for you. Let me know when.
So I was about to turn to the specifics of this case. So if you have questions with respect to the standard or our position on the standard, happy to take them.
Yeah, actually, I understand that you're saying that the length of the FET has to be tied and connected directly to the goal of reducing the likelihood of recidivism in the future. Here, the parole board did explain he's got 21 disciplinary infractions. He lacked insight into his criminal behavior, including infractions recently in terms of when they considered this for disruption, fighting, rejecting work, etc. And he needs to develop a better understanding of the dynamics of his personality defects, etc. Are you saying that those findings are insufficient to impose an extended FET, or is the crux of your argument that the board has to be more specific about why it picked 200 months, 16 years, as opposed to 150 months or 100 months or something of that nature.
I'm making both arguments, but you only have to agree with me on the second point to reverse.
So what? How would you envision the board achieving that expectation of yours, that they would sufficiently explain, okay, in this instance, he needs 200 months, not 150 or 100 or 75 or something else?
Absolutely. So I think I have separate answers for each of the two categories. So the first category of the justification for departing from the schedule and imposing the 200 was basically he needs to develop greater insight, better understanding into his criminal behavior. And the second was the infractions. And I have separate answers on each. So I'll address why their answers were insufficient and then also why I think this court shouldn't even credit their conclusions with respect to both of them. So first on the need to develop better insight or better understanding of his criminal thinking. The board says Mr. Cohen has to do two things. One, further programming, and two, introspection. So the board didn't identify any specific programs. I think if the board were to say, assuming that the conclusion that he lacked insight were justified, the board could say, look, you should take focus on the victim. And maybe even we see you took it once, you need to take it again. You should take thinking for a change. Though each of those courses take 12 to 13 weeks. There's a bit of a waiting period that adds up to however many months. And it would have to be beyond the 27 to 36 month period for them to depart. On introspection, this really puzzles me. I mean, do they expect Mr. Cohen to just sit in his cell and just think and come up with a better answer? I'm really struggling with that, that he just needs to have better introspection. And I want to get more on that point, but I'll jump to the infractions first. You know, it is not crazy for the board to say, look, we need to see a certain period of infraction-free behavior in prison before we find your risk of recidivism is below substantial. But the board needs to say, well, why do we need to see more than 3 years, 36 months? Or in this case, if you looked at when his infraction was, which was in 2018, the last one was August of 2018. That was the refusal of housing, not work, although they keep characterizing his work assignment. And then his next eligibility date with the 36 months would be around February of 2023. So that's about 54 months. So why is 54 months infraction-free insufficient? Now, this court has said time and time again, we defer to the expertise of the board. And so I presume the board is up to date on social science that shows a connection between certain periods of infraction-free behavior and risk of recidivism. So if it's necessary for the inmate to have more than 54 months infraction-free, the board should explain why. What are they basing that on? And I think the reason this court should demand that and can demand that is we just look at Trantino 6. So in Trantino 6, and this was with respect to the release decision, but the same, because the standard is the same, the level of scrutiny is the same. So in Trantino 6, and I outlined this in my brief, from pages 176 to 82 of that decision, the court looked at what the board was basing its finding of substantial likelihood of recidivism on. And there were five different factors. And for each of those factors, this court said the board has failed to establish any material connection between the factor and the substantial likelihood if released on parole, he would commit another crime. So there are certain things we can, you know, take the board's word for. So a connection between, you know, violence in prison and a likelihood, fine. But if we're talking about a specific length, well, show us your work, show us the connection between that specific length and the risk of recidivism. And
along those lines, yes. One of the factors that the parole board is to consider is an objective risk assessment instrument.
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is and the weight that it is given?
Absolutely. So that is the LSIR for parole. They don't have to, they've chosen the LSIR. They could choose other ones. It focuses mostly on static factors, although it does incorporate things like infractions in prison. In this case, score represent, and this is in the confidential appendix, the score represented a moderate risk. So there's three levels. There's low, moderate, medium, and high. And the this particular score was correlated with a 28% risk of rearrest and a 17% risk of reconviction. We believe that moderate falls below the level of substantial. So, the board didn't rely on the risk assessment itself to justify the length, or even focus on the risk assessment necessarily in the denial, although they did check off on the two-member panel and the three-member panel, they checked off the risk assessment in the aggravating factors rather than the mitigating factors.
Is that a problem that they did not rely on it?
So I absolutely think that it was mitigating in this case, both with respect to the denial of release decision and with respect to the length. And I absolutely think it should be focused on, especially because the legislative history regarding the 79 Act called for a more objective standard to reduce the subjectivity and reduce the discretion. And so when they have this objective instrument, and the LSIR is actually supposed to be used as a risk and needs assessment, so suppose it identifies certain needs, they could then say, okay, the risk assessment has identified needs in these areas. That's something you could address over this FET period, which we didn't see in this case.
And in the three-member panel, in their 10-page decision, is there anything, they do make a lot of findings, as Justice Fischali noted, but is there anywhere in that decision tying those findings and their expression that they believe he needed to conduct more introspection? Is there anything tying that to the 200-month FET and the likelihood of future criminal behavior? Is there any analysis in that decision that states, because we believe this, this is why he needs an extended FET period?
No, Your Honor, and that's precisely our position. Neither did they explain why the lack of insight and the infractions required more than the 36 maximum scheduled term, nor why 200 months was necessary.
That would be the scope of the remand you're requesting.
Well, obviously we'd be happy with that result. We're asking for more than that specifically because we think the facts here and the board's reasoning couldn't even justify going beyond that maximum 36. He's now 5.5 years beyond the initial denial the initial eligibility date in February 2020. And because that's beyond the maximum scheduled term, if they couldn't justify the maximum scheduled term, there wouldn't be a remand for reconsideration of the FET. It would just be, well, you couldn't justify going beyond what's already expired, so you have to have a new hearing.
But how can you expect them to tie these factors to a specific number of months? I struggle with this idea that, let's say here they had come with 60, and you say, why not 50? And they came with 120, you say, why not 100? I mean, doesn't Acoli speak to the idea that these are inherently subjective decisions being made in the best way possible? It feels to me like what you are asking is almost impossible. Here, we're going to pin this to a number, and we're going to prove why it is that our analysis of these factors accurately pinned to this number of months, and that would be somehow not subject to substantial and material debate. I mean, I think you are asking something that's almost impossible, and the courts have recognized that it is almost impossible.
Your Honor, I have three responses. So the first is that our position is not there needs to be a crystal ball, and the board needs to calculate precisely the number of months that is required for the risk to be reduced, you know, exactly, and we have 100% certainty that it's going to be reduced to below the substantial likelihood level. But they do have to justify why the certain length is necessary and the shorter length is insufficient.
But I feel like you've just contradicted yourself. You're saying we're not requiring a crystal ball, but they do have to justify why a certain length is necessary and sufficient.
So
those feel to me like you're saying the exact opposite thing.
If if we're starting from the premise that the majority of these cases are going to be this in this beyond the schedule range, this unbounded range where they can literally pick any number they want. In terms of, I mean, we say they have to justify it, but there's no numerical constraint. And if we're operating under the idea that the majority of the decisions are going to be there, that does seem to pose a challenge. We actually think it should be the extreme circumstance in which they're going beyond the schedule because of the presumption. Before we get to the length that they actually impose beyond the schedule, they have to meet the first threshold of showing that 36 months is insufficient, which they didn't even do here. Why is 36 months insufficient to complete the programming? What programming does he have to do? And why is 36 months plus the time before his last infraction, which is 54 months, why is that period of infraction-free time insufficient to mitigate your risk of recidivism? So that's the threshold question. And I don't think that that explanation requirement or prediction is any more difficult than the prediction they already have to make in whether or not there's a substantial likelihood of recidivism. It is a difficult question. You are forecasting, but I don't think it's any more difficult.
And the administrative code, the standard is that if the three-member panel is going beyond the scheduled time frame and above the additional potential 9 months, that there needs to be a reason, and that reason would be that there's a potential like that there that time frame would be inappropriate due to the inmate's lack of satisfactory progress in reducing the likelihood of future criminal behavior. So it's not, so start from the starting point of the schedule, it's not really a crystal ball, because these are the time frames that have been determined that would be appropriate for these different categories of offenses. And then the board goes from there, but the administrative code spells it out that there's an expectation that there will be some sort of tying together. And looking at the statute, there is a focus on recidivism and not releasing. Release is expected under the 1979 Parole Act, correct? But there's an expectation that release won't happen only in scenarios where there is a risk of recidivism. So the statutes and the administrative code, wouldn't you agree, have that formula in place for the parole board to follow?
That's precisely right. And that presumptive schedule is for inmates who at the time of initial consideration did pose a substantial likelihood of recidivism. So probably the majority of them do have some sort of recent infraction, or the board thinks they don't have sufficient insight, which is frankly the most common basis for denial and a greater than scheduled FET that we see is this lack of insight. So, and even for those inmates who have a recent infraction and the board says lack insight, still it is presumed that they will be within that 18 to 36 month schedule.
So Justice Huffman,
go ahead.
Justice Huffman's point about a level of imprecision here, it's not a mathematical science that we're dealing with, perhaps was in the back of Judge Geiger's mind in his concurrence in Berta, where one of the things, the third thing that he recommended was a less deferential standard of review by reviewing courts. Do you agree? And if so, what do you recommend for that standard?
Our position is that if this court gives a clear signal, and then courts in the future hew to the substantive standard that the board, and as applied in Trantino 6, that the board has to give an explanation that does specifically tie the number, then the whether or not there needs to be less or more deference, you know, would sort of already be satisfied. We wouldn't need a less deferential standard.
So you're not biting off on that suggestion. Maybe Amiki will help.
We wouldn't be opposed to it. I just, frankly, in my practice, I've seen more relief and better results when the substantive standard is very clearly and precisely articulated than the level of review, which there still seems to be a wiggle room. You know, I will say that as far as the level of deference, just to give an example, we generally defer to the factual findings of the board. So if in this case the board had said that the reason they were focusing a lot on the 2018 fighting infraction, which is what they focused on, and why it was so troubling to them, was they did not believe Mr. Cohen's explanation. And they actually looked at the disciplinary records, and it showed he started the fight, and he provoked it. And they think that that shows he's still violent and has anger issues. We couldn't come to the court and say, well, you should discredit that, because that's a typical scenario where the court owes deference. But that's not what they said. That's not what they were troubled by the 2018 fighting infraction. They were troubled by his explanation. They accepted it, that it started because he told three younger inmates, look, you're still affiliated with this gang. That's negative. You should be thinking more positively. That provoked tension. He told a corrections officer, and then they were mad at him for telling a corrections officer, and that led to them attacking him. And the board said what troubled them about that was it shows lack of judgment in discoursing and conversing with others. So I don't think deference requires this court to say, it requires the court to defer to the findings of the board that that's what troubled them, but it doesn't require the court to say, okay, and then the fact that that troubled them justifies departing from the FET or is tied to a substantial risk of recidivism. That's where this court can and has, like in Trantino 6, said, is there any connection here? Have you shown what the connection is? And I apologize. I know Justice Wainwright had a question earlier.
It's about, in the Administrative Code section 10A:71-321 F, there's a whole discussion about if a three-member board panel or a board establishes a future parole eligibility date, which differs from the date under A and C, then it has to have these annual review hearings within 18 months for the first one and then every 12 months after that. Does that apply in this case?
No, Your Honor, those are, so I have that here. That's for 2A inmates. So that, for example, that applied in McGowan's case, which was the appellate division case. And frankly, I think that's why, one of the reasons why they sustained the 30-year FET.
So there are no review, there's no annual or semi-annual or any kind of review hearing here. It's just the FET. So there is nothing for 200 months.
So a couple of things, that is correct. However, the 200 months is reduced by commutation credit. So the board estimates that it would be about 10 years, 4 months.
Understood.
So his next eligibility would be, I think they said June 2030. There is a provision that does apply to Mr. Cohen for extraordinary progress, exceptional progress. You can have that reduced, but that's the extraordinary circumstance. Generally speaking, it would be, you're not eligible until 10 years and 4 months with commutation credits.
And in McGowan, it didn't look like there was a long discussion of the FET. I know that you are interpreting McGowan as favorable to your position, but at least on the FET part, it looked like the discussion was very short. One of your contentions is that that's because there was this review that was going to happen every 18 months and then every 12 months. And so the 300-month FET was going to be reconsidered many times before the 300 months.
That's our position, yes. And also, if you look at the record in McGowan, I mean, there was ample reason for the denial. And I think that would be the extreme case where you could then depart. I mean, you had like 8 to 10 psychological reports where he's telling different stories. They're finding him that he's lying. He's not showing remorse, or he's denying his sexual attraction to younger children, which had been established and he had previously admitted to. And the psychologist themselves found he was a high risk specifically for those reasons. So there was, that would be an extreme case where you're like, well, you're not even really accepting responsibility. Therefore, we think you need one-on-one therapy. You need some additional time beyond the presumptive.
So let's stick to that example then. What would you be asking the board to do? Accepting that that's legitimately outside the 36-month range, 27 or 36-month range, what would you be asking the board to do to tie their findings to a particular number?
So for example, suppose it were that he really needed one-on-one therapy to be able to accept responsibility and also like acknowledge that he had not been honest about some of his, I think they referred to it as psychopathy or his psychosis, I think. I mean, there are standards for what is a course of treatment for that. And you could look to, expert psychologists of how long that would take. I don't have a number that I'm suggesting, but I think there are things the board could point to in that case. And I also think that the difficulty of a number once you get beyond, I think is less so once first we start with like, it should be the vast majority of cases are within the scheduled range and should only be the exception. And even if you're on the cusp, if you have somebody, look, say it's lack of insight, have somebody come back in 36 months. And if they didn't change at all, then maybe that 36 months wasn't sufficient. You give them longer the next time. The board generally, they start with the biggest hit. So I have a client representing right now. His first hit was 20 years. His next hit was 10 years. His next hit was 9. So like, it makes more sense to me, especially if you're focusing on something like lack of insight, like show us you can, you know, is 3 years enough? And if it's not, now maybe we need to give you longer. But to start with this 200 months where they're unable to tie it at all to a basis doesn't make sense to me. I'd like to touch briefly on the specific findings. I did speak about my take on why what they found problematic about the 2018 fight. They didn't tie that to risk of recidivism. And in fact, you know, I was talking to Mr. Cohen about this, and he's like, I thought, you know, if you see something, say something. I thought that's what we want of folks in society. We have that on the subway, right? So he saw something, he said something to the inmates. And so the idea that we're going to connect a substantial likelihood of recidivism to you have to keep your opinion to yourself at all times, even if it's a positive opinion. I don't think the board connected that to a substantial likelihood of recidivism. And then just on the August 2018 infraction. So this is a refusal to accept a housing assignment. I included the disciplinary paperwork in my appendix for this court at ASA 9-18. After the 2018 fight, Mr. Cohen was moved to, he was moved out of Bayside to Southwoods. His attorney sent a letter to the board asking that he not be sent back to Bayside because of his fear of the inmates who had attacked him who were still at Bayside, and he refused. He was found guilty of that. We're not saying anything otherwise. The prisons still say you have to comply. But the board continues to reference this as refusal to accept work. That's four times in their brief, pages 7, 11, 20, and 22. And that's also in the two-member and the three-member panel, RA 55 and RA 129. So they're not even looking at the disciplinary infraction accurately.
I'm not sure I understand. You're saying that he was asking for a transfer to a different prison, and that was misconstrued as refusal to accept work?
So the DOC disciplinary infraction is called refusal to accept work or housing assignment.
Okay.
And what actually...
It's more sense.
Yes. And what he did was he refused the housing assignment because his attorney had already told them he would be in danger if he went back there. But the board keeps calling it refusal to accept work. And then, you know, just factually on this lack of insight finding, and again, you don't have to agree with me that the board erred in that finding in order for me to prevail, but it's just not supported by the record. His own letters and the letters of Chaplain Jacinto, Chaplain Dr. Akins, Imam Ali, his wife, all showed that he accepted responsibility, was remorseful, and recognized what the problem was initially. This is page 139. This is from the three-member panel, that he was thinking as a juvenile trying to get money the illegal way. In his letter, he wrote that he, at that time, he had a callousness for others. And page 65 of the appendix, he didn't see his victims as people. And then he's later talks about how now he recognizes the damage. I mean, what more do we want from an inmate than to recognize, look, I wasn't empathizing with others. I wasn't thinking about how my actions impacted others, and now I do. And although this is certainly not a part of the record that was before the board at the time it denied, in my confidential appendix, this is ASA 19, you know, Dr. Kalal noted that per his professional capacity, Mr. Cohen did display sufficient insight, and he didn't believe that developing greater insight would be meaningful in any clinical way. And then if we look at what the board actually says that they demand or they expect in order for Mr. Cohen's insight to be sufficient to reduce his level of risk below the level substantial, they say, this is on page 140, RA 140, quote, that you need to understand all components to triggers and stressors that make you think in a criminal manner. I don't know anybody that understands all the components. And suppose that were necessary. The board didn't explain how that's necessary. And this goes back to Trantino 6, where, you know, this court faulted the board for not presenting any psychological, behavioral, or, and they were looking at the board's reliance on Trantino not having psychological counseling for that he had engaged in domestic violence. And this court said the board didn't present psychological, behavioral, or domestic abuse experts or evidence of recidivism rates in relation to prior untreated domestic violence. We're asking no more of the board in this case. If they think Mr. Cohen needs to understand all components to triggers and stressors that made him act criminally, show us why that's necessary. Give us a psychological report. Give us some statistics, which they failed to do here. I'll turn to remedy, unless the court has further questions on the record. So we briefly touched upon this, Justice Fischelli, I believe, in my answer to your question. Because we believe the record does not contain substantial evidence to support the findings on which the board based its actions and clearly erred, the board clearly erred in reaching the conclusion that 36 months was not long enough, that there needed to be more than 36 months for his risk of recidivism to be reduced, that the board could not have reasonably made that decision on showing the relevant factors. And if this court agrees, then because he's already completed the 36 months, if they fail to justify going beyond the 36 months, the remedy would be remand for a new hearing rather than reconsideration of the FET. And although—
Isn't that asking the court to set the FET effectively?
If there's a presumption and this court finds, if there's a presumption that's necessary to go beyond what Mr. Cohen's already completed, because he's already completed far more than the 3 years, and this court finds the board failed to meet it, I mean, I suppose the court could just say remand for reconsideration of new FET, but if the court's made a finding—
Has this court ever set an FET in that way, or in any way, in a situation where there's a challenge to an FET?
This court is only
remanded for reconsideration.
So I mean, the only case this court has ever considered the FET was in Trantino 4, and the vast majority of that decision dealt with the denial, and there was just sort of this one sentence tacked on at the end regarding the FET. But I think in many occasions when this court or the appellate division has found a party failed to meet its burden to justify departing from an otherwise presumptive course of action, then the board would be bound by that finding on remand, and it would have to go with the presumptive course of action. I also think, although certainly not before, it's not part of the record, I had submitted the current face sheet and progress notes in my appendix that was current as of April, right before I submitted the brief. And I did receive last week and provided to Mr. Josephson the very most up-to-date face sheet, which shows no new infractions since that last August 2018 infraction.
This may be a good point to break then.
Thank you.
We'll have you back for rebuttal. We'll be back for Mr. Rosenberg in about 30 minutes.